You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Moving on, behind the podium. As President Biden's barrier-breaking press secretary leaves the White House, she considers the ups and downs of being a first, by Karine Jean-Pierre, with photograph by Norman Jean Roy. Karine Jean-Pierre, pictured in front of the White House. The moment will forever be seared in my memory. It was December 1st, 2022, at President and Dr. Biden's France state dinner. That evening was the first time the administration felt a dinner was safe to host since the pandemic began. Every centerpiece seemed just a little bit brighter, every conversation a hair lighter. We were nearing the holidays, and the White House was adorned in sweeping ribbons and twinkling lights, making the night glow. My mom turned to me and said, "This is the happiest day of my life." She had never met President Biden, and never in her wildest dreams had she envisioned being at a White House state dinner, but I figured now was as good a time as any. All night long, my mom beamed, especially when she met the president, who was beyond gracious and welcoming to her. That evening was the last time I recognized my mother as the woman I grew up with, the immigrant who had worked hard her entire life, the woman who took over every room she was in, who was vibrant and forceful and stubborn and loving. In a matter of weeks, everything changed. I was 4,000 miles from home when the text woke me up. My sister, Edwine, back in New York, "Mummy is sick, call me." I had flown into Poland the night before. Ukraine was months into war with Russia, and Biden had made a secret trip to Ukraine to visit Volodymyr Zelensky. Despite the historic nature of the trip, a crisis at home began to consume me. My mom had been complaining of abdominal pain for a while. I still kick myself for not paying more attention. When the pain ratcheted up, my brother took her to the nearest hospital, and eventually she was taken into surgery, although my mom would refuse to acknowledge it for another 8 months. The surgery confirmed a diagnosis. She had stage 2 colon cancer. My mother has always been a private person. When she finally acquiesced to reality, she told me, "Don't tell anyone. Do not tell the president I have cancer." In this way, I take after my mom. For almost 3 years, I spent every day working in one of the most public jobs in the world, White House press secretary. My job was literally to represent the President of the United States of America. From behind the lectern in the briefing room, every day I faced the press, the American people, and the world. And every day I kept my personal life hidden. In fact, it won't be until reading this that the people I have worked 16-hour days with, traveled across continents with, we'll learn that for almost 2 years, I have been silently working a second full-time job, which is navigating my mother's care. It's not just because I'm a private person that I withheld this information. It's also because I'm a first. I'm the first black press secretary, the first person of color press secretary, the first openly queer press secretary, the first Haitian American immigrant press secretary, the first press secretary to be all of the above. Being a first meant that my responsibilities were beyond those in the job description, the load heavier. I bear a certain responsibility to the communities I represent. In some ways, I have been carrying the weight of being a first since the moment my younger sister was born, and then my brother. I became the eldest sibling in an immigrant family with three kids. If you know, you know. While my parents worked three jobs between the two of them just to make do, I took charge of keeping my brother and sister fed, clothed, and nurtured. I took care of them the best I could. But being used to the weight of being first does not alleviate its burden. The feeling of gravity gently tugging me down is still there, the pressure and tightness still palpable in the air. And so, since I stepped into the White House 4 years ago as Principal Deputy Press Secretary and then Press Secretary, I have kept details about my private life under lock and key. I knew, from years of being the first in various spaces and roles, that if I were to share the news of my mother's diagnosis or any other issues in my personal life, it would be seen as an excuse. Society doesn't allow women of color to be vulnerable at work. When you're a first, you don't get the benefit of the doubt. I want to be clear. I do not regret my decision to keep my life private while in office. This piece is no apology. It's an explanation. An explanation of who I am, what I've been through, and what it's like to come from where I come from and sit in the public eye. I never thought I'd be named the White House press secretary. That's not me being modest. I never envisioned myself working in politics. I thought I'd wind up in one of the professions my immigrant parents expected of me, doctor, lawyer, engineer. But I fell into politics, and many roles later, here I am. Just 9 days after I was named press secretary in May 2022, a white supremacist killed 10 people at a grocery store in a predominantly black neighborhood in Buffalo. My first time going to the briefing room, stepping up to the podium as press secretary, was to address that tragedy. 10 days later, the Uvalde shooting happened while we were on Air Force One, flying back to D.C. from Tokyo. It fell to me to walk to the back of the plane where the press was sitting, most of whom were sleeping in a dark cabin at the end of a long flight back with no internet to inform them of the tragic and horrific news. From the beginning of my time as press secretary, I navigated the typically choppy waters of American politics. Wars, unthinkable acts, crises of every kind, natural disasters, and some of the most turbulent political events in modern history. And I have also trudged through thick, thick grief. Looking back now at the French state dinner, the signs of my mom's decline were there. Shaky on her feet, she needed me to stabilize her. My mom spent decades of her life as a home health care aide and as the nucleus of our family, holding so many people up. Now she needed someone else to do the holding. President Biden was one of only a few people at the White House I ever told about my mom. Biden is a man who knows grief better than anyone should. He knows that grief doesn't only occur when someone passes, but when someone changes irrevocably from the person you knew. As I grieved the mom I knew, the president showed up for me. For more than 18 months, I drove up to New York every weekend I could to see my mom, often returning to D.C. late at night just to get a few hours of sleep before heading to the White House early the next morning. My days began with a 7:30 a.m. team call. She was in the hospital for 3 months. My brother visited her each morning, and my sister came on the days she could manage off from work. I did what I could from D.C. My brother put me on the phone when the hospital was giving them the runaround. I demanded the names of specific doctors, told my siblings what phone numbers to track down for me so I could make calls myself. I never used my position to pull strings, but I did use my expertise, and I never stopped advocating for my mother. Once treatment finally began, we had to change her health insurance plan 4 or 5 times so that she could get the care the doctors recommended. By the time we'd successfully get her onto a new plan, her care team would ask us why she hadn't already started the treatment. At one point, her rehab clinic tried to charge her for the wheelchair she came in with. I worked for President Obama. I am extremely proud of the Affordable Care Act. I was equally as proud to work with President Biden to lower the cost of prescription drugs and begin to tackle this country's medical debt crisis. But our health care system is still too expensive, too hard to navigate, and too inaccessible. As present as I was in organizing my mom's care, I still tried to maintain a sense of privacy when I visited her. I'd wear big sunglasses, a mask, and no makeup. Unable to help herself, my mom had already bragged about me to anyone who would listen. Yet the weight of it all felt like too much. I am used to heaviness. I've navigated it my whole life. But I was losing my grip. I told my mom I wanted to move to New York so I could help her full time. "You are not quitting your job," she said, stopping me before I could finish. I stayed in my job for my mom. Quitting the administration would hurt her more than my full-time caretaking would help. My mom and I both had the support of my brother and sister, too, who shared so much of the burden. The better part of a year ago, my mom finished treatment. That same April day, I was in New York City, of all places, traveling with the president. Ironically, just boroughs away, nurses stood around my mom after she rang the bell, cheering her on as she was wheeled out of the clinic. What I couldn't allow to overshadow either of these things was a recent nasty story about me in the tabloids, that I couldn't or wouldn't do my job somehow. The next morning, I knew I'd need to get up, shake it off, and do it all over again. Because rule number one of being a first, failure is not an option. Now, here's this month's cover story, The Californians, by Anna Peel, with opening illustration by Kim Thompson, which looks like a portrait, showing Harry and Meghan standing together, smiling. Ensconced in their cozy Montecito mansion, Harry and Meghan are living the California dream, raising their own little prince and princess. By all accounts, the love is real. But 5 years after their break with the monarchy, their foray into moguldom has not always been a smooth ride. The house proved it. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex could have it all. Their Montecito home offered all the fresh promises of a 21st-century California mansion and the cloistering of a gated neighborhood from which they could emerge on their own terms. In the house's 13 fireplaces, described as mostly centuries-old examples brought over from France, there was even some European history, stripped of any potentially uncomfortable context. At $14.65 million for more than 18,000 square feet, half the current median price per square foot in Montecito, Rockbridge was a steal. The area's fires and floods, along with the fact that the oligarch owner's romantic relationship had deteriorated to the point where he was compelled to offload far below market value, according to a source with knowledge, made the property just right for the Duke and Duchess, Prince Harry, and Meghan Markle. It was the perfect launch pad for Archwell, their nonprofit and entertainment studio, an approximation of a part noblesse oblige, part aspiring independently wealthy mogul model, one that Elizabeth, Charles, and William rejected by fiat during the January 2020 Sandringham Summit. This January marks 5 years since that failed parley. Leaving the royal family has brought tests for the couple, legal, financial, reputational, personal, and practical. Going from divinely chosen, or at least chosen by someone else who was divinely chosen, members of a 1,200-year-old institution to startup founders in exile is a tough adjustment. But there has also been opportunity. Over many months, Vanity Fair spoke with dozens of people who have worked with and lived alongside the couple to understand the impact they've had on their new coastal California community, the challenges of enacting the ambitions of two first-time CEOs, and how their experience with the monarchy foreshadowed some of their current difficulties. Harry and Meghan declined to be interviewed for this article. Harry still works closely with the charities he founded, the Invictus Games Foundation and Centibail, an organization focusing on mental fitness, and the impact of poverty and HIV/AIDS in southern African countries. He has real gravitas when he speaks about his work in Africa, says someone inside the couple's circle, and he is free from Willie, as well as the future king's supposed dominion over that continent, as Harry confessed in his 2023 memoir, Spare. Africa was his thing, Harry said. Archwell also encompasses Meghan's efforts to empower and educate young women, like the 40 by 40 initiative, where for her 40th birthday, she asked 40 well-known friends, such as Melissa McCarthy and then First Lady of Canada Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, to each spend 40 minutes on Zoom mentoring a woman returning to the workplace in the wake of the pandemic. On March 14th of last year, the fourth anniversary of their flight to California, Meghan rejoined Instagram to announce American Riviera Orchard, a home goods and sundries line. Archwell Productions is in production on two high-profile Netflix series, a docuseries called Polo, featuring the world of Harry's buddy Nacho Figueras, which premiered December 10th, and a yet-to-be-named hospitality show from Meghan, as well as her second podcast. They have this naivete in their hopefulness about what's possible in terms of storytelling and good works, and all those things. says producer Jane Marie, who collaborated with the couple while they developed audio projects at Archwell and later produced a podcast with Michelle Obama. I wish I had that kind of optimism. Optimism abounded as the couple embarked on their Spotify deal in 2020, both for them and for those who were coming in to help do the work. I thought that I had the role of a lifetime, says a person who worked in media projects, who was a fan going in and eager to make the type of life-changing content Harry and Meghan seemed to want to create. I thought I was going to be besties with Meghan and Harry, and we were going to, like, run around the world saving people. Interest in the couple was unslakable, but it remained to be seen whether they were actually interesting, beyond Harry's uniquely difficult upbringing and Meghan's years of defending herself from shoddy treatment and racism, whether in the British press or from members of her husband's family. As one former Spotify employee put it, the thing you're escaping is the reason you're compelling. Those stories would be meted out in different media. Breathless reports of a $20 million Penguin Random House contract, Spare, and $100 million partnership with Netflix, Harry and Meghan. According to a representative for Netflix, we don't disclose our financial deals with talent, but I can confirm to you on the record that the $100 million figure is not correct. On the August 2022 cover of The Cut, Meghan did to promote her first and only Spotify podcast, Archetypes. She said, "I'm like so excited to talk, and it's like I'm finding, not finding my voice. I've had my voice for a long time, but being able to use it." When repeatedly asked by the interviewer what she wanted to say with her newly free voice, Meghan demurred, "I have a lot to say until I don't. Do you like that? Sometimes, as they say, the silent part is still part of the song." She said, noting, "I've never had to sign anything that restricts me from talking. I can talk about my whole experience and make a choice not to." One of the people who spoke with Vanity Fair for this story says they signed a non-disclosure agreement to be employed by Harry and Meghan. A person who worked closely with the couple and loves them says, "I have no idea what Harry's interests are beyond polo, no clue what his inner life is like." The development process was challenging. The former Spotify employee says they had this idea to do a podcast because they knew celebrities did them, a category differentiated between celebrities who get a lot of money to begin podcasting, like Harry and Meghan, and celebrities who get large deals after proving themselves to be capable podcasters, like Smartless's Will Arnett, Sean Hayes, and Jason Bateman. The former Spotify employee says Harry and Meghan didn't do what celebrities do on podcast, which is turn on the mic and talk. They wanted a big theme that would explain the world, but they had no ideas. Someone who worked closely with them on audio projects disputes this version, lamenting that because of Meghan and Harry's insistence on silence from employees and their own reticence, the public doesn't know about good projects that had to be abandoned for practical reasons. "It feels like the only story is they didn't satisfy their contract," she says. "It's not like work wasn't being done." People involved with production say the couple did trial runs on some big ideas, like a This American Lifestyle show where Harry and Meghan took turns hosting and talking to interesting civilian guests. As Bloomberg reported, Harry wanted to host a series where he interviewed powerful men with complicated stories, like Mark Zuckerberg, Vladimir Putin, and Donald Trump. The concept wasn't just that the men shared challenging early lives. It was that their experiences made them into sociopaths, or so Harry envisioned, one person familiar with the ideation process says. The person who worked in media confirms there was a sociopath podcast. The person who worked closely with the couple on audio projects recalls Harry saying, "I have very bad childhood trauma. Obviously, my mother was essentially murdered. What is it about me that didn't make me one of these bad guys? To implore a season's worth of world-famous sociopaths to talk about how they developed sociopathy would be what is referred to in access journalism as a booking challenge. As time passed, it would be nearly 2 years between the couple's deal signing and the premiere of Archetypes. Spotify began applying pressure to produce something, anything, that people might listen to. The former Spotify employee says Harry came to the Los Angeles office once and asked for a cup of cocoa. There was none in the office, so employees scrambled to obtain some. An idea was pitched to Harry. What if he reviewed a hot chocolate every week while chatting with a different friend, which he and his team considered and rejected? Another concept was that Harry would fix something every week, ranging from a flat tire to global warming. He wanted to do a podcast about disabled people who compete in the Invictus Games, the former Spotify employee says, but there's no crossover between the audience who would listen to that and people who want to hear about Harry's life. Harry and Meghan did produce a 2023 Netflix docuseries called Heart of Invictus, which significantly underperformed Harry and Meghan. In the photos, The Social Network. Meghan at a California bookstore in September. Harry and Meghan at an Invictus Games event in 2023. The gate to their Montecito estate. Candids from Netflix's Harry and Meghan docuseries. Harry visited visiting the Pointman Health Facility in Lerib-Lesotho in October. With Serena Williams at the 2024 ESPY Awards. Meghan in Dusseldorf, Germany in 2022. The couple in Abuja, Nigeria. Harry with his friend and polo doc subject Nacho Figueres. In Summerland, California. An Archwell event for mental health awareness. Bluffs near Montecito, California. And double duty. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex in Cartagena, Colombia. With Santa Barbara Fire Chief Chris Mayles, Oprah Winfrey, Ellen DeGeneres, and Portia de Rossi, and at the 2020 Invictus Games. The former Spotify employee says it was challenging to engage Harry, and a person who interviewed for a job with the couple says, I just felt like he kind of didn't want to be there doing that at this time. My expectation was charming receiving line, and it was clear he wasn't that person, at least that day. And at least in the context of a hiring manager, a person who worked on an event during Harry's book tour says he has the greatest manners I've ever seen, hands down. Like, I can't believe his knees are as supple as they are. He was getting up and down any time somebody walked into a room. He was unfailingly kind and friendly to everyone. During the interview, the potential employee says, Harry's attitude was either, well, why should I do this? Or why are we doing this? The interviewee says they wonder, didn't Spotify pay you a lot of money to do this? The person inside the couple's circle says, he looks like the kind of guy who would frankly, happily work for charities for the rest of his life, and would be very happy if Meghan made all the money and he didn't need to. On his self-titled podcast, Bill Simmons described his own experience working with the Sussexes at Spotify. The effing grifters. That's the podcast we should have launched with them, Simmons said. I have got to get drunk one night and tell the story of the Zoom I had with Harry to try and help him with a podcast idea. It's one of my best stories. F them, the grifters. Harry and Meghan became increasingly nervous about how their content would impact them. Marie says, I can say that they had really great ideas for shows, interesting pitches, interesting guests. But them as the deliverers, or either of them as the host of these more kind of edgy ideas, would have been like they would have had to move again. I think it's a combination of self-censorship for good reason, and the corporate powers that be that run podcasting that don't know what that is to create valuable shows. In combination, those things make it really hard to make good stuff. The person who worked in media projects imitates the thought process behind any decision about the couple's projects. Well, he has a million things that he has to protect, and he has the book, and they have the documentary, and they don't want to make the Queen upset, and their public image. That source says the idea for Archetypes came from another employee, not Meghan, though the employee didn't own any of the intellectual property. Archetypes began production in January 2021, though the former Spotify employee says the initial expectation was that Archwell would handle production for the series. The process took so long that Spotify studio Gimlet was called in. A source familiar with the production of Archetypes says this required additional cost to and resources from Spotify, though a current Spotify employee refutes that the extra support was a burden. Virtually the entire Gimlet team would be laid off in the year following Archetypes' release, but employees blame mismanagement at Spotify rather than any individual project. The former Spotify source says Archetypes was complicated as a podcast concept. You had to explain what the archetype was, then why the woman embodied it, but also how it wasn't true about her. Every episode was like, this is my friend who has been called that archetype, but is not that archetype. These archetypes, actually stereotypes, included Diva, Mariah Carey, and Bimbo, Paris Hilton and Elisa Schlesinger. As for those friends, there was an expectation that Meghan would be able to use her personal Rolodex to book the show, the way hosts like Simmons and the Pod Save America guys do. The person who worked in media projects says the assumption was Meghan's going to be on the phone with the Pope tomorrow. The former Spotify employee says in addition to Taylor Swift, they heard rumors that Beyoncé and Megan Thee Stallion were asked to come on the show and declined. Other people who worked on the podcast also say they heard those names mentioned. Though a source close to the situation says Megan Thee Stallion's team knew nothing about any request. According to the source and media projects, Megan would agree to provocative ideas and then walk them back. In one episode, she wanted to actually say the word bitch, because, as the source remembers Megan saying, you hear it all the time. It ended up with Megan calling it the B word. An episode titled Slut intended to center on how trans women's sexuality is used against them was retitled Human Being by Megan and had to be completely reimagined late in production. Every episode got more and more watered down and further away from actual conversation, the source says. It felt like very Women's and Gender Studies 101 taught in 2003, though the Spotify contract has widely been reported as worth $20 million. Two sources told Vanity Fair such deals are generally not paid out in lump sums. In other words, the couple would not likely have received the full amount without meeting benchmarks beyond making one 12-episode season of a podcast. Spotify does not comment on deal terms. The issues extended into the actual workplace. Terry Wood, an executive vice president at Oprah Winfrey's Harpo Productions, was brought in to be what Megan would later call her right hand when Archetypes won a People's Choice Award in 2022. The source familiar with the production of Archetypes describes Wood's anger, saying that she yelled at Spotify staffers when Megan changed her mind about episodes. Wood did not respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment. The source who worked in media projects says Megan's own relationships with employees tended to follow a familiar pattern. She would be warm and effusive at the beginning, engendering an atmosphere of professional camaraderie. When something went poorly, often due to Megan and Harry's own demands, such as a teaser for Archetypes being released 5 months before the show premiered and before there was any tape to promote, Megan would become cold and withholding toward the person she perceived to be responsible. The source says it was really, really, really awful, very painful, because she's constantly playing checkers. I'm not even going to say chess, but she's just very aware of where everybody is on her board. And when you are not in, you are to be thrown to the wolves at any given moment. In practice, they say, that manifested as undermining. It's talking behind your back. It's gnawing at your sense of self. Really like Mean Girls teenager. Marie had a different experience with Megan. She's just a lovely, genuine person, she said. The person who worked in media projects read stories in the tabloids about Megan bullying palace aides and couldn't imagine such behavior actually happened. After working with her, though, this person realized, oh, any given Tuesday, this happened. While it beggars belief that Megan actually shouted at a palace aide, as has been reported, a person who interacted with her professionally says, you can be yelled at even if somebody doesn't raise their voice. It's funny that people don't differentiate between the energy of being yelled at and literally somebody screaming at you. Two sources say a colleague with ties to Archetypes took a leave of absence after working on 3 episodes, then left Gimlet altogether. Several others described taking extended breaks from work to escape scrutiny, exiting their job, or undergoing long-term therapy after working with Megan. The person who interacted professionally with her says, I think if Megan acknowledged her own shortcomings or personal contributions to situations, rather than staying trapped in a victim narrative, her perception might be better. They added, with the soggy laugh of a plebe rendering judgment on the Duchess of Sussex, but who am I to criticize Meghan Markle? She's doing great. It's hard to imagine how someone who seems so earnestly intent on being kind and engaging in world-improving, if also brand-building, activities could wind up engaging in revanchism with people so below her in status. A partial answer might be found in an episode of Archetypes, in which Megan interviews Mindy Kaling, who assumed Megan was popular as a child. While attending Immaculate Heart Catholic School in Los Angeles, Megan tells Kaling, I never had anyone to sit with at lunch. I was always a little bit of a loner and really shy and didn't know where I fit in. And so I was like, okay, well, then I'll become the president of the multicultural club and the president of sophomore class and the president of this and French club. By doing that, I had meetings at lunchtime, so I didn't have to worry about who I would sit with or what I would do because I was so busy. It brings to mind Swift's Mastermind lyrics. No one wanted to play with me as a little kid, so I've been scheming like a criminal ever since to make them love me and make it seem effortless. In other words, Megan was a good person trying to do good things in spite of and at times because of unkind people. The person familiar with the production of Archetypes said at least one employee who had a terrible experience got a handwritten thank you note and a gift from Megan. Is it any surprise that a sense of victimhood and righteousness could continue to exist in a person who had been treated so horribly by the press and her husband's family? Not to mention those little B words at Immaculate Heart. That people whom Megan may have perceived as enemies or interlopers, members of the loathsome media, or insiders at the palace, or people who actually knew how to make a podcast, or her pitiable father and half-sister selling her secrets and history to tabloids for cash, might have seemed more powerful than her in some way, despite her immense fame and wealth and privilege. And then whatever happened to them, well, they shouldn't have gotten between Megan and her good work. As Harry knows, trauma can warp your perspective. Spare, Harry's best-selling and beautifully written by J.R. Moringer memoir, chronicles the prince's lonely former life with MRI-level self-examination, if not always top-tier self-awareness. Harry recounts an anti-poaching trip to Namibia, in which he insisted on sleeping outdoors, despite his team telling him, We just saw proof that there are lions out here, boss. Harry claims everyone with him, including a bodyguard, local police, a ranger, and Namibian soldiers who were all there to protect him, went to bed in their tents or trucks, rather than staying up to ensure he wasn't eaten by lions in the night. The book also discusses in great detail Harry's issues with his family, opening on his reunion with now King Charles and Prince William, who, in addition to beloved brother, Harry describes as his arch nemesis, possessing a familiar scowl and alarming baldness. It doesn't get more flattering for Willie in the ensuing pages. At an event in 2023, someone privately asked Harry if he'd heard from his family. He said he hadn't. This person asked Harry if he thought he was going to, and he said he hoped so. "That's sort of what made me so sad," the source says. "His hope seemed very genuine, and I was just kind of like, oh no." The source believed Harry hadn't absorbed the gravity of what it would mean to sell millions of copies of a tell-all book about a famously insular and circumspect family in the middle of a years-long public relations crisis. "The power of the written word and the power of the narrative," this person went on, "I don't know if that's something he understood while he was doing it." In addition to painting Dorian Gray-style personal portraits of family members in spare, Harry accuses the offices of his brother, father, and Camilla of briefing the press against Harry to distract from or trade away negative stories about themselves. Harry sued the publisher of the Daily Mail for libel for publishing an article in 2022 that said Harry tried to conceal his efforts to obtain taxpayer-funded security. But the prince ultimately dropped the case, and a judge ordered Harry to pay the Mail's publisher nearly £50,000 in legal fees. Harry is currently involved in two other lawsuits that further alienate him from his home country and its tabloid media. He is moving forward with an invasion of privacy case against Sun publisher News Group Newspapers, which follows a settlement from Mirror Group Newspapers for a phone hacking charge. And as your reader, I'm going to insert a comment here. You may have heard that that suit was recently resolved. Now back to the article. But more isolating is the suit regarding state police protection for him and his family when they are in Britain, which Harry, Meghan, and their older child, Archie, were stripped of when they left the UK in 2020. There are clear dangers to the family's safety. A person who worked closely with them says strangers take lifts to their house, and in 2023, the couple was involved in what a spokesperson called a near-catastrophic car chase with paparazzi. There were no injuries, collisions, or charges filed. The person who interacted with Harry in 2023 also described a very scary paparazzi situation after employees at the hotel where Harry was staying allegedly tipped off photographers to his presence. Nevertheless, the High Court in London twice struck down the UK lawsuit. Harry is appealing. According to someone familiar with Harry and Meghan, the legal case was at least part of the reason Harry didn't attend the June wedding of his longtime friend Hugh Grosvenor, Duke of Westminster. The source says he'd come back for the event. The source says if he'd come back for the event, it could have imperiled his claim that he needs government-funded protection. "Well, you were here in May, and you were absolutely fine attending a wedding," the source says, imagining the response in court. "So I'm sure a lot of the decisions about time in the UK are also being made based on how it looks for the case." Of course, there's also Willie. The source says that after invitations went out, Harry and Grosvenor had a conversation. Vanity Fair has also reported that Harry may not have formally been invited. The source says they discussed Harry's discomfort at the thought of being remired in the familial claustrophobia of Windsor Turf. It suddenly becomes all about the brothers. And did they look at each other, and how close were they stood, the source says, which is exactly what happened at Charles's 2023 coronation and their uncle Lord Robert Fellowes's funeral in August. You can imagine the Zapruder footage-level scrutiny by the press. The source says they miss Harry, or at least the person they pretended he was in their papers. I think with a lot of the reporters, they like the version of Harry that they helped create, they say, describing how they would reminisce about when Harry would come over and pal around with them. Yes, but he also, when you left, would make fun of you all behind your backs and hated you guys. But who is the real Harry now that he's been released from the zoo in which he was raised? By one telling, the person who interacted professionally with Meghan says he's socially marooned beyond his nuclear family. She was upfront about the fact that Harry hadn't made many friends yet, the source says, of Meghan's assessment of her husband. The person who worked in media projects with the couple also has a guess. I think Harry doesn't know what he wants because he grew up in a fishbowl, and so he doesn't know what real life really is, they say. I think he probably wants to be left alone and be able to go kiss babies every once in a while, but not have to worry about money. I don't think he wants to be famous the way Meghan wants to be famous. Harry and Meghan are, in the estimation of everyone Vanity Fair spoke with, deeply in love. They are so hot for each other, the person who worked closely with them said. Like, you know how you meet those couples where you're like, the way they're looking at each other, I should probably not be here right now? When Harry is solo, the person inside the couple circle says he's very personable. He's very at ease with people, quite like Diana. He just has this way of, like, making people feel very comfortable. When he's in public with Meghan, there is a circus, the source says. He's so protective of her because people are so nasty to her. It's a whole different experience. Harry has explicitly drawn parallels between his wife and his late mother. My deepest fear is history repeating itself, Harry wrote in a 2019 statement about Meghan's treatment by the press. I've seen what happens when someone I love is commoditized to the point that they are no longer treated or seen as a real person. I lost my mother, and now I watch my wife falling victim to the same powerful forces. While Harry is vigilant about Meghan's safety, the person who worked closely with them says Meghan's role in their dynamic is caregiver and facilitator. She's the one who makes things happen. Pre-Meghan, says the person familiar with the couple, Harry would just pop into the palace press office, ask a few questions, and leave, like he was a little bored, but also very keen. It's almost impossible to imagine today's Harry willingly engaging with the media in search of purpose. The source who worked with Harry and Meghan says, I can picture him meeting Meghan and being just a deep breath of, like, I've been so exhausted and you make everything so easy. I don't want to be like, oh, it's an Oedipus thing or whatever, but it kind of feels like she's reparenting him in a way. It's easy to imagine a folie à deux emerging from the singular blend of circumstances, a need to believe in each other and the primacy of their relationship in the face of shared trauma, and the real obstacles they encountered as they idealistically endeavored to break the wheel, while occasionally breaking the spirits of those tasked with executing their shared vision. You don't tell them no, the person who worked in the couple's media project said. I left because I couldn't live with myself anymore. This intra-couple permission to stray from other people's realities may have led to some of the points of contention that people bring up when questioning Meghan's fidelity to emotional truth about literal truth. Her assertions that she neither Googled Prince Harry nor looked up the etiquette for meeting the Queen of England and didn't know she was supposed to curtsy until the ride was over. Megan is the type of woman who would check a menu out online before going to a restaurant to pick what she was going to eat, says Tom Fitzgerald, a fashion and cultural commentator who, with his husband, Lorenzo Marquez, comprised the brand Tom and Lorenzo. A resident of Montecito who ate lunch in the same restaurant as Megan said the server told her Megan had called ahead to ask about the privacy of the seating arrangement. So the idea that she didn't know she was supposed to curtsy for the queen, I just didn't find it particularly believable, because based on everything she ever told us about herself, I cannot imagine that she went into meeting the royal family completely cold, with no research whatsoever. Fitzgerald also points to Meghan's repeated claims that she was forced to wear neutrals during her time in the palace in order to avoid upstaging or competing with Queen Elizabeth and other senior members of the family, noting that Meghan's wardrobe is now primarily composed of that palette. A Royals reporter believes that Meghan assumed her husband's vision rather than researching the job of being a royal, and the reporter has a more positive view of the Foley. Oh, that's such a good idea for a successful marriage, the reporter says. It's a terrible idea for a job, but if you're joining this big network of people, you've got to see this through your husband's eyes. Be your husband's advocate in it. And it's no wonder this relationship works, even if the family business part of it fell apart. It's charming. It's a charming, if Freudian, dynamic. A husband and wife who organize each other's lives and well-being, who flirt and hold hands and want the world to be a better place, even to the exclusion of evidence that suggests their well-meaning way of disrupting institutions is not always the best approach. That instinct to do things as Harry and Meghan believed they should be done, rather than how they are typically accomplished, was exacerbated during their time as senior working royals. It led to conflict with Harry's family and palace staff, the reporter says, because Harry doesn't understand himself. He doesn't understand a monarchy. His family didn't do a very good job of inculcating him into the family legend, partially because he didn't care, partially because he was just kind of abandoned at the age of 8. However, the couple's regal charisma, while without effort changing the world, has been showcased to great effect on their most successful reimagining of monarchy and Markle, Harry and Meghan's common royal tours to Nigeria in May and Colombia in August. Invictus Games for sure is a very clear product, a brand, an organization that Harry spent a decade building, which is why, in many ways, I think the Nigerian tour worked, says Elaine Louis, the celebrity commentator behind Lainey Gossip. When they appear together in non-Invictus circumstances, that's when people are like, I'm not really clear what they're representing here. That's contrasted with an actual royal tour, when individuals are acting on behalf of the sovereignty and its various causes. Or, as Louis points to, an independent actor like Angelina Jolie, who went to places like Afghanistan and Ukraine with the backing of the United Nations Refugee Agency. In September, Harry appeared in front of a small group at the United Nations in New York to highlight issues in Lesotho, one of the countries where his charity, Sentebale, focuses its efforts. Louis says she could leverage the history and the reputation of a very established philanthropic organization to say, hey, I'm lending my celebrity to this cause, and in raising this awareness, we can actually attach the effect or the results to the UNHCR. With the gauzier parts of Meghan and Harry's tours, what Harry called the reasons to meet the people at the heart of our work, Louis says the question is, how are they helping anyone? And how is Archwell distinguishing itself from any other foundation? After raising more than $13 million in 2021, according to public disclosure forms, the charity grossed $2 million in 2022. The nonprofit has not yet shared its 2023 or 2024 revenue. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.